Good morning. So last time we talked about sort of a general overview of this class, which in that sense we're focusing on how processors are built. We talked a little about why you might want to care about that, even if most of you aren't doing actual processor building professionally and don't really want to. And we had said there are things about knowing how processors work which will be helpful. In particular, we talked about sort of two big previews of future topics, which were parallelism and caches that will come up a bunch later in the semester, and some other things like that where, how processors work is a big impact on sort of the software you might write. We had a very simple, without any of those extra features, model of a processor we talked about to start with, where we had a processor connected to a memory. And the memory was this thing which stored bytes, and all it did is respond to requests from the processor to get bytes or set bytes, or set values, I should say, which are often more than one byte. And the processor sort of ran this loop where it asked for some bytes, figured out what those bytes meant in machine code, possibly asked for bytes to do what that machine code said, or set bytes, set that values to do what that machine code said, and kept going. And in this model, the memory stored both the actual instructions in the form of that machine code the processor would fetch, and many of the values the instructions would use, but the processor had some of its own storage that was independent of the memory. We had what we called the register file for all those registers you're used to from assembly. And we also had a program counter, which stored the address of the current instruction. So we knew where to fetch machine code from. We can't rely on the memory to store that reasonably. Now, one thing which came up is that we thought of memory as an array of bytes, but a lot of the things that our processor works with are not single bytes. We have machine code, which is usually not single bytes, but we have, more obviously, we have lots of numbers that our instructions can act on. You move a value from memory that's an integer, not a single byte, and there's a question of how we interpret that as this bigger integer. And we have to make a decision called endianness when doing that. We have multiple pieces that we have to combine some way into a single value. We have to decide how that's done. And for memory, this matters because we have these pieces, which are each byte, that we can access separately. If I can access byte 0, 1, 2, and 3, I need to figure out, well, if I access them separately, as get particular values, what does that mean when I access them all together as a 4-byte number? And there are different choices we can make for that. And we mentioned the choice that we're going to make in this class, which is that we're going to use this choice called little endian, where the byte with the lowest address, the lowest index, has the least significant part of the bigger value, namely the ones place. So we also started looking at assembly a bit, which is going to be our main topic for today and next time. We're going to talk about some things in assembly related to AT&T syntax and some things which are just things in assembly that we probably should go over because you won't have seen or them in 2150 or won't remember them from 2150. And in assembly, we saw that, assembly, we have instructions that both sort of add values together and use that to access memory, and which access memory and then do some computation on that. And looked at the syntax for it. We're going to do more assembly for the first time today. Before I move on to that, though, questions, comments about things we covered last time? Okay. So first, a piece of logistics that we have a... quiz, and I should have thought of, quiz system that I should go through. So this is an example of the quiz system. It's not the real one because our quizzes are not going to be called example quiz. So the way the quiz system will work is you'll open up the quiz, and you can enter in answers. There'll be some questions where you enter in like a single number answer. And when your answer is recorded, which should happen after you move out of the box you're entering the answer in, the thing around the question will turn green. At that point, the answer is recorded and you don't have to do anything else. So if you go away from the page, if you stop in the middle, it's recorded, we will record that answer. Similarly, there's places to enter sort of multiple choice answers and so on. Also, each of the questions has a place to write a comment. If you have any work to show, this is where to put it. If you think that we made a mistake in writing the question, sometimes that happens. Generally, I'm not going to be able to answer questions about the quiz. This is mainly because if I answer a question about the quiz and tell everyone, here's a clarification on, Friday night or something like that, it's not very nice for the people who took advantage of the quiz being open Thursday evening and thought they were done. And generally the way I'll deal with any sort of ambiguity in the question is we'll grade the question as written. If the question's not usable, I'll just drop it, but I'm not going to sort of try to accept clarifying questions and so on the quiz. So quiz system, you just enter your answers. When it's green, they're recorded. You can go back to the quiz at any time. You can reload this page if you want to double check your answers are recorded. It doesn't have to be answered in one sitting. The quizzes are untimed. They'll be out Thursday evenings and due Tuesday before 9:30 because there's a 9:30 lecture and I don't want people in my 9:30 lecture sitting in front of me answering the quiz. So questions about sort of taking the quiz logistics. And okay, so the quizzes are mostly auto-graded, but obviously not the comments. So if you go to a completed quiz, I'll quiz after it's due. Oh, I should do after due, you'll see the correct answer marked with a T, and the percentages will be what other students answered, so you have an idea how confusing that question was. Also, if you entered a comment, eventually we will have myself or a TA look at it and possibly respond to it, possibly adjust the grade, possibly not. Obviously, that's not going to happen instantaneously. It'll probably take a few days. But we do intend to look at all the comments on questions that are not automatically marked correct. And as for finding the quiz system, if you go to the course website, there's a link, quizzes, which should take you there. You'll see something slightly different, but you have the place to take the quizzes here. So questions about logistics for the quizzes? And quizzes are open book, open notes, open internet, don't ask other people about the quiz questions. You can talk to TAs about the lecture topics, but obviously the TAs cannot answer the quiz questions for you. But the quizzes are mostly on the lecture topics, and if you want to review some of the lecture with a TA or myself in office hours, that is 100% okay, even if the quiz is out on that. So, questions? Comments? So let's go on to talking about assembly. So as I mentioned earlier, we're going to be using AT&T syntax because that's what our textbook uses. That's the default for the Linux toolchain, all the assembler, compiler, and so on. And we're going to talk about assembly syntax. I'm going to start with a simple example here of this move instruction. So this instruction takes the value 42, which is a constant number, and puts it in memory at an address, which is determined by reading the RBX register. And this is what the instruction looks like in AT&T syntax. And I'm going to go through the parts. So first thing to note is our destination is last. And this is going to be true always in AT&T syntax. The destination is always the last operand. When we see parentheses, that's a value in memory, kind of like square brackets is in Intel syntax. When we have a constant, it starts with a dollar sign. If I don't have a dollar sign, it's not a constant, it's a label. Or not a label, it's an address. Sorry. So this is the value 42. If I wrote it without a dollar sign, that would mean I'm asking for the thing in memory at address 42. Whenever we have registers, they start with a percent sign. If there's no percent sign, the assumption is we're referring to a label, meaning that if I wrote, you know, move RBX something, the assumption is that somewhere I have RBX colon, and that's what I'm actually referring to, which, you know, this probably isn't a good idea, but that's the assumption if you don't have a percent sign, that it's a label. There's this queue on the move. So this is a move instruction, but we have move queue, and the queue indicates the size being moved. And queue is for 8 bytes, there's L for 4 bytes, W for 2 bytes, and B for 1 byte. In this case, I have to put that there because I could move 8 bytes into that memory location, or 4 bytes into that memory location, or 2 bytes or 1 byte, and the instruction would make sense in all those cases because 42 is a value which fits in 8, 4, 2, or 1 byte. In many cases, you will see the Q, L, W, or B omitted where it's clear from the instruction what size is intended. So for example, if I have move RAX RBX, that has to be a move queue because of the size of the RAX and RBX registers being 8 bytes. I can't move 4 bytes into an 8-byte value. Some questions? Sort of these basics of AT&T syntax here. Yeah. So the question is, what would happen if I didn't have the parentheses around the RBX? So if my instruction was instead move queue $42, RBX, this is a valid instruction which modifies RBX instead of modifying memory. So this would be equivalent to RBX gets 42. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So this is sort of the simple case. So where there's the most confusion about AT&T syntax usually comes from how we specify memory addresses. So in Intel syntax, you're used to doing this kind of thing where you can write an arithmetic expression and that specifies a memory location. In AT&T syntax, they've said that we're going to have a very different format for that. And a way of thinking about it is that in Intel syntax, you write this expression, but only certain kinds of expressions are actually supported by the processor. And the idea there is that if the assembler doesn't know how it's supported by the processor, it's just going to give up. Here, we've said the processor basically supports sort of these four fields for computing a memory address, and in AT&T syntax, we have something where you just fill in those four blanks, essentially. And these four blanks are what we'll call a displacement, which is this number that we add to the address at the end, a base register, And the name of this base register is that we can kind of think of this like supporting an array access. So the base register stores the beginning of the array, effectively. The displacement is fixed offset in the array in bytes. And then we have what we call an index register, which is multiplied by a scan. And if we think of an array index, we're taking the index, multiplying it by the size of the array elements, and going that far into the array. So the scale represents the size of your array elements, and the index is the element index based on that size. And the scale here has to be 1, or 2, or 4, or 8. You cannot use any other values. They are not supported. So this is sort of the most general form, sort of specifying a memory access. So questions? Yes?
So the percentage sign between each register's name, just that indicates that it's a register?
The question, the percent sign just indicates it's a register? Yes. So every time we write a register name, we're writing it with a percent sign. Other questions? Yeah. What is an instance where this is actually used? This is often what an actual array lookup will compile to. Not always, because I would say, like, you saw this simpler form here, right? We could do all our memory accesses with only this way of specifying a memory location, just by doing the additions ourselves. So this sort of complicated way of specifying addresses is a convenience feature x86 is provided for assembly writers. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
Just for this example, if I was declaring this array, would it be inclusive of RDX?
So question, if we were declaring this array, what type would it have? Is that the question? Or
would it, does it, like in Python, it omit the second or the ending index? So would it include RCX?
The question is, how would this array include RCX? So the bounds of the array, we don't know from this instruction alone. So we know that if this is an array access, it seems to start at RBX or maybe RBX plus 100. That's the beginning of the array. And hopefully whoever is running this code has somehow checked that RCX isn't bigger than the array. But that's not handled here. If there's a size to the array, that's not handled in this code. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Back there. What's written in red? Oh, sorry. I wrote display and didn't complete it. So I meant to write here. This is the name for this. You'll sometimes see, we're not going to test on this, is displacement. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question for Intel syntax, why do I have to write pointer? I probably don't, but I'm showing the most complete form. So Intel syntax supports writing pointer when you're accessing memory and offset when you're not, which you'll see sometimes if you're trying to be very explicit in that. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is the most general form for accessing a memory location. Well, the most general form we'll learn. But there's other forms which are basically just omitting parts of that. So if I don't actually care about a index and a scale, I can just omit them. In which case, I'll access memory at, say, displacement plus base. If I don't care about the base, I can have my displacement and my index times scale, which I can write in these two ways. I have all of them. I can also omit the displacement base, sorry, the base, index, and scale, and just have a single number. And when I have a single plain number without a dollar sign, that's a memory address. So access is memory at address 100. And similarly, I can omit the scale, in which case it defaults to 1. So questions? These general versions? Okay. So we've seen accessing memory locations. So one consequence of something I talked about at the beginning, so do the destinations last. And we still have the same instructions, and this means that the add instruction still computes the same value even though the destination is written in a different place. So this add, subtract here, I think of it as it's a subtract RAX from R8, which might not be what you were expecting. That's because the destination of the subtract is lost, and it's still the same subtract instruction you were seeing in Intel syntax as far as whether it subtracts from the destination or from the other thing. It subtracts from the source. Or subtracts the source from the destination, just like the Intel instruction, but this means that it's maybe not in the order you were expecting. And related to this, the compare instruction, as we'll learn probably next time, the way it works is it basically computes RAX, or it does the subtraction, and then compares that to 0. And that means the compare, because the destination is last, works in the opposite way you may be used to from Intel syntax assembly. So questions about how our ordering affects subtract and compare? Okay. So I mentioned earlier we have addresses, that if I have just a plain number, that means an address. If I have a dollar sign, that means a constant. So this first add takes a value at address 1000 hex, reads the value, and then adds that to RAX. The second one just adds the constant 1000 hex to RAX. It doesn't access memory at all. So questions? Okay, and so one more thing. Where did I put this slide? Okay, so labels. So labels are like values you see, you know, in assembly you have like foo colon and then some instructions. Foo is a label, and you know, you can like use foo, you can like jump to foo, and you should think of labels as placeholders for an address. So when we convert this into machine code, we're going to choose that this is at some memory location, and writing jump foo is going to be equivalent to writing jump to that memory location. And this also applies for other uses of labels. So if I have a string here that's a label, label string, if I add string to RAX, I'm accessing the string's value as an integer and adding it to RAX. This probably wouldn't be intentional. Probably doesn't make sense. If I take dollar string, I'm using the address as a constant and adding it to RAX. So this is like doing something like getting a pointer to the X character of the string. And remember, sort of our basic idea is that when this is converted to machine code, we're going to choose an address for this. And effectively, you should think of the label as being replaced with that address every time, as if I just wrote the address. Yes?
So
question, when I'm using labels, I typically put the dollar sign in front of it and sense what I'm using them for. So for strings, most often I'm working with pointers, but you know, for example, I might, if I did move B string into AL, this is the correct way to retrieve the A, character A. This is gonna take B, AL gets A, effectively. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, if I put parentheses around string, would that do the same thing? So that would be a syntax error, because if we look at our options here, if I have parentheses, it needs to have a base register in it, and the string is in the register. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so here's our sort of basic summary of AT&T syntax. So there's one other thing I want to mention, because not because we're going to test on it, but because you might see it in the assignment next week, which is about computed jumps, which use this star in AT&T syntax. And this is basically like dereferencing a pointer. So jump star RAX means is take the value in RAX and execute machine code at that address. The reason why it's not just jump RAX without a star is because that would imply that we're taking the contents of RAX and actually executing it as machine code, but that's not what it does. We use RAX as a pointer to the machine code. Similarly, this second jump star and some thing in memory, this doesn't actually execute machine code at that memory location. Instead, that memory location contains a pointer to some machine code. We read that pointer, so we access memory by adding RAX and RBX times 8 in the 1000. We get some value there, which is a pointer, and then we use that pointer as the address of the next piece of machine code to run. And so there's a star to indicate that we aren't actually running the machine code in this, presumably an array, where the array just contains the address of some machine code. So questions about this star dereferencing? Syntax that we see on jumps. Okay. So we've had our summary of AT&T syntax. So here I have some instruction in AT&T syntax. Now the question is, what is it trying to do? Also, it doesn't assemble, so why? But first, what is it trying to do? But second question is, why doesn't it assemble? This is something you may remember from 2150, is why it doesn't assemble. That's something we actually talked about explicitly. And you can talk with your neighbor, see if you figure out what's going on. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks for our first question. A? B? Okay, C? D? E? No clue? Okay, so it looks like we have a majority saying B, and let's go quickly over that since not everyone got that. So this add instruction, it's add two values, and this takes the destination, which remember is last, written right here, and adds to it. So it's destination plus equals something. What's our destination? It's this thing with parentheses, which is this memory access. So this star here, this is going to be memory at the address we compute by taking RAX plus RCX times 8. And if we think of, you know, that, you know, value plus value times a number, that looks like an array access where our array elements are 8 bytes. So we're advancing by that 8 bytes RCX times, and our array starts at RAX. So it looks like, so this is like sort of, you know, array at RAX index RCX, assuming if array has 8 byte elements. So that's our star, and what's the first thing? Well, it's a label, and a plain label means a value in memory. So we're trying to take our other upper hand is going to be memory at the location of foo. Location labeled foo. So somewhere we have a foo colon, and that's the and that address is where we're trying to access memory. And so that's how we get that we're adding foo. So presumably it represents a variable. That's what makes the most sense. Maybe you thought E because maybe we don't really have enough information to be sure it represents a variable. It's okay. And we're adding it to an element of this array at REX. Questions? How I came up with that answer? Or any part of it? Okay, so does anyone know why doesn't this assemble? Yeah?
You're accessing memory twice.
We're accessing memory twice. So one of the things about x86 is that even though we have a way of expressing instructions that, you know, add two values in memory together, that's not actually an add instruction that exists, so it won't assemble. So the why doesn't it assemble? We're accessing memory twice, and there's no such add instruction on our processor. Questions about that? Yeah?
So in order to, like, I guess accomplish this, you have to, like, call or, like, store foo somewhere and then add.
So the question is, if I wanted to actually accomplish this, how would I do that? Would I have to store somewhere? So if the most common way you'd see a compiler do it is it would move one of the two operands into a register to do the operation. And maybe move it back if it changed. Other questions? Okay, so we've went through one example of 86x. Let's go through sort of another example. So here I have a function I call swap. This is a swap function written in AT&T syntax, just to remind. Well, so remember we have our destination last and value in parentheses. We're just using a memory access using a particular base register. So what does this do? So our first instruction, we're taking our source, which is our first thing because our destination's last, of this move is going to be a value in memory where we compute the location in memory using RDI. So we take the value of RDI. In this example, this is 4000. I access memory at that location, and I see a value there. And because this is a move instruction, and the memory location is the source of the move instruction, we're going to take that value in memory and copy it into the destination, which is the register RAX. There's no parentheses there, so we're accessing RAX directly, setting it to a value. Our second instruction does the same thing, except we find our memory location using RSI, and we store the result not in RAX, but in RDX. So here we get this all sevens value copied into RDX. So questions so far? Okay. So then we look at our following instruction, and we see here our destination. It has parentheses, so this must write to memory because that's where our destination is. And our source is RDX. There's no parentheses, so we aren't going to access memory. We're just going to use RDX directly. So RDX is all, this all sevens value now. And where are we putting it? Our destination in memory. We compute using RDI. So we're writing to 4000 the all sevens value. And then our final instruction writes RAX. No parentheses, so we're accessing RAX directly using that value. And we're accessing memory as our second operand, so we're using RSI as a memory location and writing the RAX value into that. So questions? Reading this? Uncomfortable? Okay. So far, all the examples I've shown have used the 64-bit registers. You probably remember seeing smaller registers. And basically, we have names for parts of the big 64-bit registers. So, for example, EAX here is the name for the least significant 32 bits of RAX. AX is the name for the least significant 16 bits of AX, and I've shown here sort of the naming convention for all these sub-register names that exist. I don't expect you to memorize them. You can look them up if you need them. But I want you to know that that's a thing which exists. And one question might be, well, if I set EAX to something, what does that do to the rest of RAX? And probably the most sensible answer would be that, well, it doesn't change it because it's just a name for that bottom 32 bits. And, well, the designers of x86 needed to make a choice about this, and they made both possible choices for different ones of these registers. So when the 32-bit registers are set, it clears the whole corresponding 64-bit register. And I'm mentioning this primarily because for the assignment next week, you're going to look at assembly compilers generated, and you'll see the compilers doing things which don't seem to make sense, where they assume, like, they set EAX and RAX doesn't have extra, junk in it. And that's okay, because the rule is, if you set EAX, it clears the rest of RAX. And you also might see them not assuming that for other registers, and that's because for the 8 or 16-bit registers, if I set them, it doesn't clear the rest of the bigger register they're a part of. So for example, even though AL is the bottom 8 bits of RAX, when I set AL, it doesn't set the rest of RAX. That's still the same. Even though when I set EAX, it does set the rest of RAX. And this is just a choice the designers of x86 made. You might say, why were they so inconsistent? My guess, I don't know for sure, is that at the time they were moving from 16-bit to 32-bit registers, the second option was faster and more convenient for the hardware. And at the time they were moving from 32 to 64-bit, the first option was faster and more convenient for the hardware designs of the time. But that's my speculation. Some questions about how these sub-registers work? Yes? The question, does setting the 8 or 16 clear the rest of the 32? No. So as you can see here, I set the bottom 8 bits, and that just set 8 bits, 2 hexadecimal digits. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we have these registers, and these sub-registers for smaller values, and one thing we're going to want to review, hopefully quickly, but that you see on 2150, is calling convention. So we're going to be assuming the Linux x86-64 calling convention. Generally in this class, just for sake of making a choice, and basically calling convention means we have to make a choice about how functions work. And one of the important things about how functions work is, well, where are the arguments and where's the return value? And the choice that 64-bit x86 Linux made is that the first 6 arguments go in RDI, RSI, RDX, RCX, R8, and R9. And, well, what happens when you're passing an argument that, like, isn't 8 bytes? The decision is it goes in the smaller sub-register, so for 32-bit EDI instead of RDI, for example. And the return value, conventionally, goes in RX, the return value being the value the function returns. Not to be confused with the return address, which is the place the function returns to, the instruction that runs after the function returns. And sometimes, 6 arguments isn't enough. The convention is that the rest go on the stack. I don't expect you to memorize this. You can look it up. I've told you where it's in the book. You can look up the slide. You can look up elsewhere. But I want you to be aware of it. And if you're reading assembly, it's sure as handy to know the calling convention because, you know, for example, if I see a function called addTwoNumbers and I figure out what the arguments to the function are, I can make an educated guess about what the function is going to do with those numbers without actually reading the function. And this might be useful for other reading assembly things. Yes, that guess could be wrong, but it sure is a lot faster than trying to read through, you know, more complicated functions. So the way this calling convention works out is you'll see, you know, when we call a function here, so here I call have the function foo, which takes 3 arguments. To pass those arguments, I just set the registers for them. In this case, the arguments are ints, which on 64-bit Linux are 32 bits, so they go in the 32-bit subregisters. And similarly, this function returns a 32-bit int, which is why it's setting EAX and not REX. Questions about this example. So setting the arguments and return value, that's one part of something we need to know to call functions. There's some other things we need to know. So one of them is kind of set by the instruction set for x86. There's this call instruction, and it calls the function. How does it work? So it pushes the address that's just after the call onto the stack, and we call this the return address. This is the instruction we want to run when the function's done. So in the case of foo, after foo's done, we want to run whatever instruction is here. So this is gonna be the return address. And so the call instruction is gonna push that onto the stack, and the return instruction is gonna pop that from the stack and go to that location so we can be back in the code that called the function. So questions about call and return? So there's one other thing we need to know for our calling convention, which is about what happens to registers that we aren't using for arguments or return values. And in particular, we have to make a choice that if I want to use one of those registers, do I need to worry about other functions also trying to use the register? And the Linux calling convention made the decision that we're going to have these list of registers that functions must preserve, meaning that if I'm writing a function, I have to assume that whoever's calling me is going to rely on these registers not changing. This doesn't mean I can't use them, but it means if I do use them, I have to save their old value and then restore that old value before I go back to the code that called me. And these registers are RSP, the stack pointer, which often we change, but we always make sure we go back to the same location on the stack before we return. RBX, RBP, which historically was used for something you may have heard of called a frame pointer, and R12 through R15. And this choice of registers, this is just an arbitrary choice. Don't expect you to memorize it. You can look it up. But they just chose some. And the other registers, the functions don't need to preserve. And that means that if I'm writing a function and I want to store a temporary value, I can use, for example, R11. It's not on this list. R10, not on this list. That's perfectly fine. But if I'm calling another function, I have to assume that that other function took advantage of this and is using R11 and R10 for whatever it wants to do. And so sort of the simplest way of dealing with this is that we can save, for example, to the stack, these calling save registers, the ones the functions must preserve, you know, at the beginning of the function and restore them when we're before returning. And in this way, we make it so this function foo here can use the callee save register R12, do whatever it wants with it, and it's not going to disrupt other function that's calling us, even if other function uses R12, because it's not going to notice the other value of R12 we sent. Similarly, other function here was using R11. And when it calls foo, foo might be using R11 in here, and it doesn't have to save it, because it's a caller safe register, meaning that if someone wants to save it, it's the person calling another function that needs to save it. So in this case, I've saved the value of R11 by putting it on the stack, and then I restore it afterwards. So even though the function foo might have changed it. Some questions about caller and callee saved? Sure, so sort of the way to remember is callee saved. Callee is the thing that is called. Is called. Needs to save. Okay. And somehow people are either a lot quieter about this or a lot less confused than the last lecture. One of the two. So that's caller callee saved. Again, yeah, look it up if you need it. The other registers. Yeah. And I just have this list and you look that up. And this is just a choice that was made. They could have chosen other registers, and the designer said, we want to have a good number of callee saved registers and a good number of caller saved ones, so they split them up in some way. Questions? Okay. So let's here have a little hello world example. We've seen labels and so on. So I have a label hello. I have a null terminated string. And I'm going to call a function called putS. putS is very much like printf, but simpler, doesn't have formatting, just takes a string, outputs it. And it's declared to take a pointer to a character, so a pointer to a string. Presumably that character is the first character of an array of characters terminated by a null. In this case, the assembly directive.string creates one of those as sort of the initial value that's at memory at the address that hello ends up at. And in this example, I take hello, the address of hello, because remember, the labels represent the addresses that stuff is stored at, and put it in RDI, which is going to be the first argument. I use RDI, not EDI, because pointers are 8 bytes, so I need the full 8-byte register. And then I call putS. I wrote call Q. I could have also written call. Q just represents that it's a call with 8-byte values, because, of course, we have 8-byte addresses. And that's my example function. So questions about how this works? Because the next slide is an exercise that's more complicated. Yes?
So will putS always pronounce
an RDI? Question, will putS always pronounce what's an RDI? Yes. In particular, what RDI points to, which is assumed to be a null terminated string. If it's not a null terminated string, putS is probably going to have problems. Yes?
Yeah, I'm a bit confused about the dollar sign, because I mean,
question thought dollar sign is pretty constant?
Right.
Yes. So the way I think about this is that when this is turned into machine code, we're going to replace this hello with an address, right? Where we actually place that. And this hello is going to be replaced with the same address. So the constant is an address, and it's whatever address is chosen when we make the executable. And it's still a constant because in the executable, it's fixed, even though we haven't decided it at the time we wrote the assembly file. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So here, have a slightly more complicated example. My question is, this calls put s, but we have some other stuff happening. Question is, what is put s called with? That's its argument. And you can discuss with your neighbors. You have a minute or two work through what's happening here. Who would like some more time still? Everyone has some sort of answer? Okay. So who thinks our answer is A? Okay, B. Okay, C. D. E. F. Okay. G, H, I, okay, so we have a split between like B and D and F and I. Probably, let's go through what's going on here. Someone want to give me an explanation of what their thoughts are and how you should start looking at this? What was the first thing you looked at? Anyone? Yeah. Okay, so you first looked at this move B instruction, you said hello plus one, this is the byte after the start of the string. So this is byte after the start of the string. And why is it that? So one way of thinking about it is, remember I said we can replace labels with the address. So if this string is located at address 0x123456, if that's where we decide, then this is 123456 plus 1. That's going to be what that first operand is, and there's no dollar sign, so it's going to be accessing memory at that address. And to know what's at that address, we need to think of, well, how is this string stored? And if we remember, ASCII, everything's one byte, so we have our first byte is the number that ASCII uses for capital H. Our second byte is the number ASCII uses for capital E, and for L, and so on, until we have a terminating null byte or zero. So questions about sort of that so far? So this means that we're getting, so if this is 456, this is our plus one value here, and that this instruction, this first instruction here, moves that value into BL, and that's going to be the ASCII for E that's moved into BL. So that's what our first instruction does. So questions about how I figured that out? Okay. So we figured out in the start that we move ASCII for E into BL, and then what happens to BL? We have this subtract instruction. The B there represents that it's a one byte subtract. And we have the constant one. How do we know it's a constant? Because there's a dollar sign. So we're subtracting one from BL. And it turns out in ASCII that if you subtract one from the ASCII character for an E, you get a D. If you didn't know that, you could have looked up an ASCII table and figured it out. So this subtract instruction is going to set BL becomes D. That is going to be E minus 1. Subtracting 1 from the E. Then our next instruction is going to take the value in BL and move it to hello. And remember, we can think of this as having hello replaced with the address, but it's the address of the H here, because that's the first byte of the string. So this is going to replace that H with the D we just computed. So questions so far? Yes. Can I explain the third line, the move me to hello? So so remember the way labels work is that this is the same as writing, assuming hello is at the address 123456, same as writing move BL, comma, OX123456. So what this does is remember our destination, which is memory, at OX123456, because there's no dollar sign, it's a memory like address, gets the value in BL. Does that answer your question? Yes. So the question is, what would happen if I had a move WBL, comma, hello? And that would refuse to assemble because BL is 1 byte, and you can't move 2 bytes out of a 1 byte value. If we move from BX into hello, it would modify 2 bytes using whatever was in BX, which we know the bottom 8 bits, but we don't know the other 8 bits. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
To move the, I guess the values stored in BL, we need like parentheses.
Question: if we move the value stored in BL, do we need parentheses? So, when we use parentheses, we're saying I'm trying to access memory using the thing that's in parentheses. BL is just a register. If you remember our processor, it's in that register file part. It's not part of the memory. So we can access it and are accessing it without touching the memory. And it turns out that if we try to like put do write parentheses BL, that wouldn't assemble because addresses in memory are 8 bytes and BL is not 8 bytes. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so finally we have this move $hello into RDI, and remember hello gets replaced with the address of the beginning of that string, so we're passing into RDI the address of this, well now this D, that's at the beginning of the string, and that's going to tell put S where the string is, and it's going to look at the string and look for the null terminator and output everything up to the null terminator. And so this is how we get answer of B. I think the second most common answer was C, because people presumably weren't paying very close attention and said, oh, we got the E, made it into a D, and didn't realize we weren't actually writing it back to the same place. So questions about that last step? Yes, Beth? How does it know to go all the way to null? This is how the code in Prodest is written to search for that null. And if there is no null, well, it's going to still search for it. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I have this explanation here. So I have this written out so you can see what we showed before. Questions about this exercise? Okay, so we're going to cover a few more things in assembly. So I'm going to cover one more thing, which is theoretically 2150 review, but I know people have lots of trouble with it, which is LEA, which I know is instruction people have a lot of trouble with in this class in 2150. And we're just going to mention it mainly because you're going to see it in the assignment next week because compilers use it. And then we're going to talk about some things that are definitely not things you've seen before in assembly, namely how condition codes work. Like, you've seen compare, and so on, like, how they actually work. Talk briefly about LEA. The other lecture didn't get to this, but we'll just start this, and then we'll start next time with an exercise on it. So LEA stands for load effective address. So this is a case where there's an exception to the rule we talked about that when you see parentheses, it accesses memory. Basically, load effective address, it computes a memory address like move would, but rather than actually talking to the memory and saying, please give me the value at that address, it just takes the address and uses it. So for example, LEA for parentheses REX comma REX is the same as adding 4 to REX. Why is that? Because basically it says our operand here is memory at REX plus 4, and LEA takes the address of that. It's called the effective address because the effective address is the name for an address we compute in the middle of running an instruction. So it takes that effective address, REX plus 4, and takes the address of it as its result rather than actually accessing memory. And one consequence of this is that, and we'll talk about next time, and you'll see probably in assembly compilers generate, is that you can use this instruction to do an addition, and compilers do that sometimes. And the reason why compilers would do that, well, it doesn't make much sense with this add here, but it makes a lot of sense if you want to like multiply by 4, because, well, there's a multiply by 4 we can do with our address computations that doesn't have an obvious fast instruction for it. So you'll see this sometimes being used not to compute addresses or just to compute arithmetic. And we'll talk about that next time. So questions before I call it here? Okay, see you next week. And remember, we have a quiz that we'll release this evening.